Blog Talk Radio.
And the collective wisdom. My name is Kate Loving Schenck of KateLovingSchenck.com, author of the Prayer Prescription series and creator of Uprooting Our Fear of Death, Bringing It Out of the Closet. My guest today is Bernie Siegel, and his latest book is called The Art of Healing, Uncovering Your Inner Wisdom and Potential for Self-Healing. I just finished this book. It's wonderful, and it is a work that nourishes our soul with wisdom. Joining me now is Bernie Siegel. Hello, Bernie.
Hi, how are you, Kate?
I am so well, thank you.
And, you really are?
I was just reading.
Okay, because
over the last few hours, I've been reading your, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, most people, when you ask that question, deny, they all say fine. You know, that they use it instead of saying hello or good morning, they say, how are you? And I always ask them, do they really want to know?
Well, fine is, that is a terrible, I think it means effed up, insecure, neurotic, and emotionally unstable.
Oh, that's good. Okay.
So tell me, I would love to know what brought you to writing this book. I mean, it's probably been a real evolution of consciousness for you.
Well, yeah, I think part of it is that keep evolving. Never did I ever think I'd be writing 13 books, but and I have to honestly say this because I have in some of my books that I often say there's nothing new in this book, but it's modern language, if you know what I mean. It's what's happening now. Because, you know, somebody could read a Buddhism, the Bible, some other, you know, spiritual writings, and you may not come away or philosophical with the knowledge that's in it because of how it's worded. And I feel that there are universal themes that we need to get across that all these sources are saying. And I try to make them practical and apply them to life today, as well as the things that I thought I was discovering that I realized you didn't discover, that these were known. But because of how specialized medicine and our world becomes, well, let me put it in practical sense what happened. I started working with drawings after Elizabeth Kubler-Ross looked at a drawing I did of an outdoor scene that I created from my imagination and began to ask me questions like, why is 11 important? I said, I've been doing this new work 11 months. What are you covering up? What do you mean? You have a white piece of paper. You picked up a white crayon and added a layer when you made snow on the mountain. What are you covering up? It was all my emotions. So by the time she was done with me, I thought, I'm going back to the hospital with a box of crayons and get patients to draw. And then I thought I was discovering incredible things. So I sent the articles to medical journals. It came back saying interesting, but not appropriate for our journal. I thought, okay, I'll send it where it's appropriate, you know, psychotherapy and other things. It came back again saying, yes, these articles are appropriate, but they're not interesting. We know all this. That really bothered me. That I've gone through all these years of training and nobody ever told me about, you know, art and therapy and a whole host of things. Or that, again, through my reading, I discovered that Carl Jung diagnosed a brain tumor from a dream. I have never met a physician who ever has heard that story while in training, you know, in medical school or afterwards. And those are things we need to tell health professionals. So they talk to patients, open their minds, ask them, have you had a dream? I mean, one of my, the previous book to The Art of Healing is called A Book of Miracles. And we just collected fascinating stories from people that, you know, there's no intellectual way to explain how these things happen. You know, the so-called no coincidences. And one woman went to sleep. In her dream, a dark-skinned doctor with an accent, a woman, comes in and says, you have a lump in your breast, you need to look into this. The woman woke up and indeed felt her right breast, and there was a lump there. And so she goes to the hospital, diagnoses cancer. They tell her the doctor who will be directing your therapy and treatment is coming into the room in a few minutes. She's lying there. The door opens. Who walks into the room? A doctor from India, a woman with an accent, and it's the one from her dream, the same person that was in her dream. Now, you explain that one to me, you know? And people, I mean, we had a cat named Miracle, and she was. She lived for over 20 years. But why did we get, you know, we got a kitten named Miracle? Because a lady said, I had learned to have cancer. I went to sleep, and a white cat named Miracle appeared and said, I mean, the cat said, my name is Miracle, and then said to her, here's the treatment you should have for your cancer. And the woman woke up, wrote it all down, and gave it to her doctor, who, thank God, listened to her and didn't say, ma'am, you're crazy. You know, I'll decide everything. And she's alive and well. And to me, that is no accident, you know, that these things happen. So I'm trying to show through the drawings, dreams and drawings, how our psyche, you know, the psychic aspects of our life, the unconscious speaks, as well as somatic aspects, the body speaks. And my comment really is that the reason we sleep at night is to let these things happen. Because while you're thinking and worrying and wondering, what am I going to do with it, those things can't get through. I call it the lid. You're keeping a lid on because you're so busy thinking. Well, a lawyer said it very well. He said, and I always say being a lawyer is a serious illness because they're taught to think. And he said, in the midst of a crisis, I came to a conclusion that was eminently reasonable, totally logical, and completely wrong because while learning to think, I almost forgot how to feel. You see, in the midst of a, you know, a health disaster, he was thinking about what's the right thing to do, you know, with various objects and, you know, where do you put things, park cars. I mean, and then he realized, dumbbell, you need to be with the people. Never mind all the mechanical things. Yeah.
Well, it seems to me like the drawings actually have a curative effect.
Oh, yeah.
People.
Yeah. Well, because they reveal the truth in several ways. I always tell people, tell your kids, draw a picture of the home and family for the refrigerator. Don't tell them you're going to analyze it. Then look at it. You'll see how your kid feels about the family. And I have to say, when I go into, you know, grade schools, 70% of the drawings don't look like a family. And the teachers are always amazed. How do you know those things about these people? I said, it's in the drawing. You know, the child put it there.
Well, it seems like people might think that you're just especially talented at interpreting those drawings. But I got from your book that we could all do that if we put our intuition into it.
Past, present, future. The colors have meaning. You know, it's like the rainbow is your life in order. And as a matter of fact, Solzhenitsyn, in his book Cancer Ward, uses the symbol, a rainbow-colored butterfly, related to self-induced healing. See, not miracles or spontaneous remissions. He talks about self-induced healing. I mean, one of the men on the ward, and a rainbow-colored butterfly. And when I read that, it's like, yeah, you've been there, you know. The butterfly is transformation. The rainbow is life in order. So you learn you have an illness. You change your life, create order and harmony, and your body gets that healing message too. So those are the important things to understand. And another is that when you do a drawing, I mean, let me give two examples. One, as I said, you know, when you talk about children, child has cancer. There's six people in the family. They're all in the office, and she said to me, I don't get enough time for my family. And I thought, you know, because a lot of times doctors say to me, who has time for drawing? Who has time to talk to six people about what do you do all day and why does mm-hmm. she feel this way? See? So I said, draw a picture of your family. She drew herself sitting on a chair. Everybody else is on a sofa with the parents' arms sort of wrapped up around each other. And there's an empty seat on the sofa. She could have been with them. And when the parents mm-hmm. saw that, you know, they just said to me, thank you. We see how she feels. And they went home. You see, and I'm not criticizing them then.
No,
or no. It's their child. It's just her feelings that are portrayed there. The other is to say, draw your treatment. Some people, literally, I don't make up any of these stories or lines, draw the mm-hmm. devil giving them poison as their treatment, say, for their cancer. Well, you are going to have a lot of trouble, ma'am, if the devil's giving you poison. And then others will draw chemotherapy as yellow energy flowing right to their cancer. And even, you see, their intellect, this one man said, I don't really want to get chemotherapy. I said, draw a picture. And it's beautiful. I said, mm-hmm. intuitively, you know it's good for you, but you're afraid because of what you hear of it. But what I know yeah. is when people see it, and some draw it as a gift from God, they don't have side effects. I mean, one of my patients said to the radiation therapist, I get out of the way, let it go to my tumor. She didn't have any problems with radiation. Then there are other people who aren't being radiated because a mechanical problem with the machine who acted mm-hmm. as if they were. And so the radiation therapist told me he didn't know he wasn't treating anybody for a month till they did the routine inspection. And
wow,
what was
like
fascinating
the ultimate...
is, mm-hmm. yeah, they all had side effects and even shrinking tumors because they believed what they were getting. So that's where the drawings can be so helpful, because if you get it, like a lady drew a picture of herself in the operating room. It's totally empty black box. She's lying on a table with two legs. I said, then don't go. Change doctors. She said, no. I want to go ahead. I like the doctor. I said, then you have to change your image. So 4 or 5 times a day, picture yourself going to the hospital, having surgery, doing beautifully, going home, feeling well. Next week, she came in, drew a picture. It's gorgeous. The family's waiting outside. The husband's right next to the operating room. It's filled with doctors. There are now 4 legs on the table. There's a window with God's light shining in. I mean, yeah, I can say to her, go ahead, no problem now.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and some people draw the operating room to begin with the surgeon hugging them and love and God and flowers are filling the room. And I mean it, that I've had patients wake up after major surgery and just say, yeah, I'm a little sore, but I don't have any pain. The nurses couldn't get over it. You know, I mean, it was an affectionate term to say that this is one of Siegel's crazy patients. But they would tell me, your patients are refusing medication. I said, did it ever occur to you that they don't need it? And it took them, you know, time to readjust to the fact that somebody could not need it. Yeah.
It's like the drawings help accelerate their healing in a very powerful, well, accelerating it, making it go much faster.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, what you're doing, as I say, is reprogramming your body, because by imaging it, your body thinks you're doing it. You know, it's the way athletes train, too. You know, they picture themselves doing something and doing it right. So it mm-hmm. becomes the process, you know, whether it's hitting a golf ball or, you know, throwing a football, it doesn't matter, or playing tennis or whatever. You picture yourself doing it, your body thinks it is. And so if you picture yourself having treatment with no problems, hey, you've confused your body. So when it goes in, it is retrained and expects to do well because it's done it, you know, 100 times before it really happens.
Now, it would seem to me people who can't remember, who think they can't remember their dreams and they start doing these drawings, that the drawings may really help them to remember their dreams. I don't know for sure, but it just seems like that would be true.
Yeah. No, for a lot of people, I mean, my feeling is that when the dream is significant, you don't forget it, if you know what I mean. You wake up and, oh boy, you remember. You know, I get emails from people all over about their dreams, the ones they remember. So I know, yeah. I dream and I wake up and, you know, it's more like going to a movie kind of dream where it's not a big deal and I, you know, I don't worry about remembering in details. And then there are other dreams where I have had information given to me that's been very significant, even medical. I mean, years ago, I had bloody urine, and my partners were, you know, basically yelling at me to hurry up and go see a doctor and get it evaluated because I was very busy, so I was waiting a few days. And that night, I went to sleep after they yelled at me, and I was running a cancer support group, which I was doing. And I said to everybody, introduce yourselves. And we went around the circle that we were sitting in. And when it came my turn, I'm about to open my mouth and say something when everybody in the room says, yeah, but you're here, but you don't have cancer. And I knew I didn't. You know, I knew they were telling me about my symptom, that it wasn't anything to do with cancer. And that was true. I mean, I did go and get it evaluated, and it was related to an infection. But when I had that dream, I woke up knowing I'm okay. And there are other dreams that have also been very significant that, boy, when I wake up, well, many, many years ago, I was wondering, are you helping people with life-threatening illnesses, like sitting behind the desk to prove that you don't and you're not going to die and, you know, that you're doing it for unhealthy reasons, see? And I may add, I moved my desk against the wall so I didn't separate myself from anybody. But that night I had a dream again. And we were in a car, a bunch of people. I wasn't even driving. And it went off a cliff. And they're all screaming and yelling, and I'm sitting there comfortable and quiet. And they're looking at me like, how can you be like that? And I realized it's because I'm not afraid of death, that this is not why I'm doing this, to prove I'm, you know, invulnerable. And so things like that do happen. And, you know, we can have, again, dreams about the past, present, or future, just as in the drawings, because there are positions on the page that represent time sequences. So if you were saying, where should I live, what job should I take, what school should I go to for college, where you put it on the page can help you know what the intuitive side of yourself is telling you is the best choice.
And when you notice that the patient or your, you know, the people you're working with, they must have quite the aha moments when they realize what these drawings mean to them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the other is, you know, I mentioned a number that Elizabeth asked me. Jung talked about that, too. He said numbers are created and created and invented have meaning and quantity. And what I realized, as he went on to say, that that's how we store memories, through numbers. And some that are in the drawing, I mean in the book, one was a reporter who came to interview me. And I knew this was not her choice to interview me. I mean, she thought, I'm a little crazy, but she got the job, you know? I mean, she was an intellectual and was wondering where I'm coming from. And I thought, to make this a more interesting and, you know, not, you might say, difficult interaction, I'll get her to draw a picture. And that may change things. So I said, I'll finish up with the patients, draw a picture, and then we'll talk. She came in, handed me the picture. In it, there's a clock with one hand pointed at 12. And with most people, I would say, why is a number 12 important to you? But I wanted to shake her up. So I said, what happened when you were 12 years old? She said, I don't like deadlines. That's what the clock is about. I said, there's only one hand on the clock pointed at 12. And then she burst into tears and told me that she'd been abused at that age. See, then the interview is different. And I may add, her head is pretty sizable in the drawing, too, where she, because she drew herself, which proved my thoughts about her being very intellectual. But, you see, those are the things that change people. Or a woman with a pelvic problem. This drawing isn't in there, but a doctor friend sent me this drawing. He said, after I told him to get her to do one, he said she has a pelvic problem. I mean, she's been to innumerable doctors. Nobody seems able to fix this, you know, treat it, get it her to feel better. I said, tell her to draw a picture and then send it to me. The picture she drew was a heart, like a Valentine heart, but it's cracked right up the middle. It's split open, and 21 drops of blood are coming out of it. I said, ask her what happened when she was 21. And I got an email back that she, I mean, it filled the page. She was sexually abused over and over again. And, you know, my feeling is, you see, that those memories were stored in her. And now that it's brought forth, she can begin to heal. Because when you keep them locked up, Alice Miller starts a paragraph in one of her books, a psychologist, with our childhood is stored up in our bodies. And it ends with, and someday the body will present its bill, for it is as incorruptible as a child who, while still whole in spirit, will accept no compromises, and it will not stop tormenting us until we stop evading the truth. You see, and when the picture brings it forth, then people, you know, stop evading it and deal with it. And I may add another symbol, and I hope you don't mind my, I never stop talking. But the other thing is words become symbols too. Well, two things. Words, if you write words, 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 they become swords, swords, swords. So we can kill and cure with words. But I also realized in treating people, I didn't want to just treat a diagnosis. That wasn't the person. So I would say to patients, what are you experiencing? What it's like to be going through this? And if they said, well, I have colon cancer, I said, that's a diagnosis. I'm asking you, what is it like to live with it? Oh, failure, roadblock, draining, pressure, constriction, confusion. And I'd say, how do those words fit your life? Whenever they were negative words. I mean, if they said it's been a wake-up call or, you know, it's a curse that's become a blessing with what it's taught me, fine. But when they said negative words, my next statement would be, how did those words fit your life? And boy, it's amazing the reaction I would get from people. I mean, in some cases, believe me, it cured them in 10 minutes because I'd say, go home and take care of the other things in your life that fit that. And it could be, you know, a marriage or a job or another relationship. Or, as one woman who said, failure, my parents committed suicide when I was a child. That must have been a failure as a child. And, I mean, she was afraid of people because they could hurt her like her parents did. And so that word and my asking made her change her life, literally. You know, I mean, she started to heal her life because of the illness. You know, the to me, the metaphor or symbolism is, because somebody said it to me over the phone one day when I wasn't having a good day. And she said, Bernie, do you get upset when you're hungry? I said, no. What do? I get something to eat. She said, okay, then ask yourself what nourishment you need. And I love that. I mean, and I share it with everybody. So when you have a problem, instead of getting depressed about being depressed, say, what nourishment do I need to bring into my life to help heal this problem and, you know, stop me from feeling this way?
Well, it just seems like the pictures, the drawings, help people to release themselves from these wounds and the past. Mm-hmm. And otherwise, you might become a slave to your past. Because, as you just said in the quote, your past catches up with you.
Oh yeah.
In the form probably of rigid body and and chronic illness and possibly cancer and so forth. But to release yourself from your past would release yourself from these chronic conditions. It would seem
to
me. I'm a nurse, so I'm very interested in this topic. That's for sure.
And I think nurses tended to be my biggest supporters because they were more aware of the patient's life than the doctors were.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the doctors were treating a disease. I mean, there's one ad that was in the New England Journal of Medicine. It said, from Sandoz Pharmaceutical Company, it said, I'm depressed. I went to see my physician. He prescribed an antidepressant. I feel better now. I wrote them. I said, excuse me. I'm depressed due to a tragedy in my family, and all the doctor does is give me a pill. Couldn't you put in another sentence before he prescribed an antidepressant that says, tell me, what's going on in your life? Why are you depressed? See? And they canceled the ad. But that's the part that drives me nuts. See, I'm depressed.
Yeah.
Here's a pill, you know, or you need an operation. It's never to look at the person and their life. And a lot of doctors years ago, I mean, we've had more studies now, so I don't get blamed for things. But, you know, when I would say to patients, what's going on in your life? You know, what could have made you vulnerable to be sick now? Doctors would say, why are you blaming your patients for being sick? I said, I'm not blaming them. I'm asking them why they might have gotten sick now. You know, you could have the death of a loved one, lose your job, have your house burned down. I mean, all kinds of things can happen. And now we know, you see, things like loneliness affects the genes that control immune function. We know the benefits of dogs and cats, you know, after heart attacks and all kinds of problems, how they lead to your survival, lower your blood pressure, and keep you healthier. You know, again, the relationships, how laughter, cancer patients who laugh for no apparent reason five times a day had better survival statistics than a group that were told, you know, laugh if something funny happens, but that's it. You don't have to laugh for no reason. And those are the things that, you know, now we've had different studies. Well, one that really I thought was quite fascinating was done by a graduate student. He took two actors, a male and a female, and gave them two scripts. While they were reading them, he drew their blood. If they were reading the comedy, the immune function went up, stress hormone levels went down. Then he gave them a tragedy in which the man has murdered the woman's husband, and they meet. And, of course, that had the opposite effect. The immune function went down, stress hormone levels went up. And this was at University of South Florida years ago, and I was sitting there listening to the professor talk about it, and I thought, wow, these are actors. It's not their life, and yet it's affecting them. So think of the effect it would have on you if it was your life. And that's why I look in poems, in novels, movies, shows, for certain, you know, words of wisdom, because often the authors have observed life. And so what they do is write about their observation. And there's a poem I often recite by W.H. Auden called Miss G. A couple of lines after a doctor examines a very lonely woman and finds she has cancer, he's home having dinner, and he says to his wife, cancer's a funny thing. Childless women get it, and men when they retire. It's as if there had to be an outlet for their foiled creative fire. Now, we have proof that he's right. You know, he observed life. But I've had doctors say to me, just because it rhymes doesn't make it true. See? I mean, they're in another place. They're living with a set of beliefs that stop them from accepting new information and wisdom. I always say, I don't live by beliefs, I live by experience. If something works, then I believe it, even if I can't explain why it works.
Right. Do you work with people withdrawing who have lost, say, a baby at birth?
Not a lot because of the kind of, you know, work I do. It's more with people with illness. But I do also run some groups for what I call people having life's problems and pain. See, because what people often do, I mean, I'm just thinking of, they'll draw like a spirit, if you know what I mean, in the picture, you know, whether it's a child or other loved one, and put it in there. And truthfully, what I've learned from my experience in life, because I've had a life with near-death experience, past life, I mean, and none of which I sought. I mean, these things happened to me accidentally, in a sense, because of things that people said. I mean, the near-death was choking as a child on a toy. But I will say to them that your loved one, their consciousness is still here. And I had a patient, I didn't know it, she was a mystic. Once she realized I was not a normal surgeon. I remember coming in the office saying, now that we know you're not a normal doctor, I brought some messages for you. And she would give me people's names, and I knew who they were, and they were dead. And she had messages from them that were, well, I mean, just so people understand, one was a message from Frank. Now, there was a doctor named Frank who was in our support group, died of cancer. She comes in and says, a message from Frank. If I'd known it had been this easy, I'd have bought the package a long time ago and not have resisted so much. So I call his wife. I say, is a message from Frank. She said, oh, my God. I said, what do you mean, oh, my God? She said, every time we'd leave your meeting, Frank would say, I can't buy the package. Now, that's a hell of a statement, you know, because his wife was just shocked out of her mind, you know, when that happened. Yeah.
What a message. Yes, a true message from Frank.
Yeah. And, you know, in the drawings, too, that would happen, that you would see these things, you know, predicting the future, what's going to happen, whether a disease had come back or not, all those things that people intuitively knew and portrayed it. So I could often help them get ready for, you know, like a CAT scan. The next CAT scan would show the cancer, but the drawing showed it even before they had the scan. Because they intuitively knew that it was there.
So it just seems to me that, getting back to the grief thing, when people are in a profound state of grief, it's because they don't know that their loved one is sitting right there with them.
Yeah.
They've cut that off.
I tell them to look for signs. Because, again, some of the stories that you know, are in my books that I just share that have happened to people, and I tell them to look for signs. I mean, one of the signs I always look for are pennies. Because when my mother died, I found about 3 dozen pennies, and the great-grandchildren and grandchildren called them pennies from heaven. And, and let me say, when I found them, see, I would go pick up our mail. On the way back up my driveway, I'd find a penny, and it wasn't there on the way down. I mean, I wouldn't have missed it, if you know what I mean. And I knew my mother was, she's always confirming all my beliefs. So I tell people, look for these kinds of things. I mean, one man, before he died, said to his wife that he, you know, he loved eagles. He said, look for eagles. If you see an eagle, you know it's me and I'm connecting with you. Well, you know, his wife thought that's a little nuts and, you know, where are eagles going to come into this? But anyway, one day she gets, her birthday comes up and she gets a gift. And it turns out to be a big kite. And as she opens the package and puts it together, it's an enormous eagle in the shape of a kite. And so she called the person who sent it and said, why? She said, I don't know. I went in a gift store and I had to buy it for you. I had to buy it for you. So I did and I mailed it. And those are the kinds of things I always say are no coincidences. And they're there. And I'll tell you, when you go to meetings for compassionate friends, you know, the parents of children who have died, that's where you hear the stories. The door is shut. We're all together. We can talk here and be safe. And, you know, one kid dies. He was into butterflies. The father's out walking, sees this gorgeous butterfly that follows him on his path, goes home, looks it up in his son's book. It's a South American butterfly. What's it doing in Connecticut, you know? You're driving on the parkway, and a pigeon stops in the on the parkway and says, Mom, slow down. And the woman knew her son loved, you know, pigeons. So she slows down. Said, I came around the turn. There was a sheet of ice and 20 cars piled up. I would have been in it if I hadn't gotten the message. And another woman whose daughter was murdered, she said she loved birds. And when her sister was married outdoors, a bird was in the tree, made such a racket, it disrupted the wedding. And everybody was saying, oh, look, your daughter, you know, is here for the wedding. Our window is open. This is a, you know, a group therapy session. She's talking. In the window at that time flies a bird. Everybody's reaction was, hey, your daughter's here too. You know, I mean, see, and you sit in a room for 5 years with the window open and no bird ever came near the window, and then one flies in. I mean, no coincidences.
No, there aren't.
Yeah. And it is our consciousness, and if we pay attention to it and connect with it, then wonderful things happen.
I love what you say about your animals, all the animals that you have had, and how animals are really at the core of our healing. Well, what about the people who don't like cats or dogs or animals? I feel sorry for them, but there must be a reason for that.
That was what I was going to say. Well, they don't like themselves. See, one of the things I found fascinating is, and I hope you don't mind if I give you a test question, what's your favorite animal and why?
Well, dogs have become my favorite animal at this point.
Why do you like them?
Well, because they make me love myself, I really believe.
You mean they're lovable?
In the sense, they're so lovable that I feel a huge state of expansion when I'm with them. All dogs, but the ones that are in my life give me constant companionship. And and I just love to be in the moment with them.
Because, I mean, the reason I bring that up is that when you say to people, what's your favorite animal and why, what they really are talking about is themselves.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, I had a young lady who was suicidal in my office, and she said, I'm here to decide whether to commit suicide. I said, what's your favorite animal? And she started describing this eagle soaring through the sky, this beautiful bird. And by the time she was done, she looked at me and said, I am not committing suicide. I mean, she knew she's talking about herself.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I had another lady in who's terribly depressed, and I thought, I got to trick her into loving herself. I said, what's your favorite animal? I hate pets and killed my canary. See, so when you said, what about when people don't like their pets or don't like animals? I'd say they don't like themselves.
Mm-hmm.
What we see in others is within us, you know? And, I mean, that lady, I knew I had a lot of problems to try to get her to care about and love herself. And when you don't grow up with love, as Schweitzer said, you don't have a reverence for life, yours or anyone else's. So when you are not loved by your parents in a study of Harvard students, by middle age, 98% had suffered a major illness. If you said, yeah, my parents loved me, 25% had. I mean, go into any assisted living facility, the 80, 90, 100-year-olds, and say, did your parents love you? And 90% of the hands go up. Of course, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Go to a high school, you'll get the opposite, see? You can go into a high school and say, write suicide notes, why you should commit suicide, write a note why you should be, you know, you're loving and worth loving.
Mm-hmm.
And you ask any high school student which pile is going to be higher, and they all tell you, oh, the suicide pile. It is. It's 3 to 5 times higher. Now, the good thing about it is the kids start talking to each other then. You know what I mean? They realize I'm not alone in all this. And it actually lowered the suicide rate in one school system that began to do this, because a lot of times the teachers say to me, what are you doing? They'll go home and kill themselves. They don't. Yeah. But
that's a beautiful idea.
But
I
you
not,
see,
I
if you did
that
to seniors, if you say to seniors, write a suicide note, they look at you like, what are you, crazy? No, I'm not going to do that. You know, they don't even bother to take the time. And one, because what I often say to seniors is, again, pictures, see? Draw yourself today and 25 years ago. Everybody handed me 2 pictures. I used to be slim, had hair, and was happy. Now I'm fat, bald, and unhappy. One man drew 1 picture, and I said, Bill, how come only 1 picture? Look at what I wrote. And in the margin, he wrote, that's me then, that's me now. This was the most loving, in a nursing home, I was doing this, most loving guy you ever want to know. He never worried about himself. He was out there in the hallways, you know, helping others to feel better. And the only person who has a memorial, I may add, in that nursing home is him.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a picture of himself that is in the library because he is immortal. I mean, because of the love he gave to everybody. And I found that really confirming, you know, lots of authors writing, the only thing of permanence is love, and love is immortal. It makes all things immortal. Hate dies every minute, and it goes on and on. But it's true. When you see something like that happen, you know, it's not an accident or a mistake.
No. It's wonderful to think that people who live a long life also love life.
Yeah. Well, it's, you see, if you love your life and your body, I mean, this is what I say to people. I say, look, if I'm going to summarize everything I'm trying to teach, it's love your life, love your body. Then mm-hmm. your body gets a message. Mm-hmm. What do I mean by a message? I mean, just as with the actors, your feelings become your body chemistry. So when you love life, your body does all it can to keep you alive. And that's where the self-induced healing happens. I mean, it's our potential. You hate your job, don't like where you're living, whatever, marriage, and they tell you you have a few months to live, so you straighten everything out. And this is a quote from a letter I got. The mm-hmm. doctor told me I had 2 months to live. I thought maybe he's right this time. So I went home and I bought a dog, put in a backyard wildlife habitat, laughed more, took some vitamins. And the letter ends with, I didn't die, and now I'm so busy, I'm killing myself. Help, where do I go from here? See? Those are, you know, in different studies, you have a heart attack, home to a house with a dog. A year later, 5% of the people died. No dog in the house, 26% had died. And another study said if you had a cat in the house, you had a 25% less chance of having a heart attack. And when stockbrokers were sent home with blood pressure medication and a dog. Of course, mm-hmm. whose blood pressure went down further? The ones who had a dog sent home with them. And they were allowed to bring mm-hmm. it to the office too. Yeah. When you pet a dog, this was a study done, your oxytocin and serotonin levels go up. Those are bonding hormones. So, I mean, anybody yeah. who walks a dog knows. I mean, everybody talks to your dogs, and then they start talking mm-hmm. to you. But
there's nothing like walking a dog, is there? Oh, my.
Yeah.
It is an oxytocin release, and that is the most profound
right.
peace, sense of peace a person can have.
And I think when you bring your children up with that reverence for life, I mean, we had a house that was a zoo. I'm not going to explain it, but we broke every zoning law, had fenced in creatures in the front yard, and I'm not talking about a farm, I'm talking about an acre and a half. But nobody ever reported us, not even the police when I would call them sometimes for some exotic pet that I couldn't find in the house. Because, I mean, people were giving us pets, veterinarians were, you know, when they didn't know what to do with these creatures, people, you know, would get them and then decide this is crazy, it's too much. So they would call me, I'd say, fine, we'll take it. But what it did, see, I see this in our children. They have a reverence for life. One of our kids... Mm-hmm. is in law enforcement. I won't get into details, but he's got a gun. He had to say, I can kill someone in order to go through the training, which shook me up a bit, just knowing, you know, this as part of his training. But he said he was in a training session, went for a walk, found a turtle that was lost in the street. And he said, I spent half an hour to find a pond to put it in. And his sense of humor was, it must have been a male turtle who didn't ask for directions. But you see, the thing, when I read that, I thought, wow, here's someone with a gun who's capable of killing, and he spends half an hour of his day to save the life of a turtle. That's a hell of a state.
I love him already.
Yeah. And when you think about the kids going into schools and shooting people, it's like, oh, my God, you know, what is going
yes.
on here? Yeah.
Well, Bernie, we have come to the end of our time together, even though I feel like I could talk yeah. to you forever. But I want people to go and buy The Art of Healing, just Uncovering Your Inner Wisdom and Potential for Self-Healing, a beautiful, beautiful book. And it's been a pleasure. It's been a like thank my you. life's dream to talk with you. So thank you.
Well, my final statement is always related to our running out of time, that we're all going to run out of time someday, so enjoy your lifetime.
Yes, so true. So peace and love to you.
Thank you.